The Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are many more women in the military, and I always start the Veterans Committee with some writings that women, military, actually combat veteran, women veterans write. And this one was written by Staff Sergeant Chanda Jackson in the U.S. Army. They gave us classes about not being out at certain times. This is a woman, okay? Do we have a curfew? Not really, but did they want you to use some common sense and not be out there wandering around? Yes. So there were issues when it came to things like that. They gave us classes on women being raped over there, not just by someone that was a national local, but by men in the military themselves. You wouldn't think that you would have to deal with something like that, but it's a reality you had to come to terms with. Wow, I was naive not to even think that could happen. Did I know anybody that it happened to? No. We had a few soldiers where we had to really enforce curfew because they still didn't feel like they were in any type of danger. They felt like, oh, it's okay, I'll be fine. I have so-and-so to walk me back. And I'm like, you can't trust anybody. And it wasn't just the military. We had civilians, contractors who were trying to be friendly, and you just had to keep your guard up across the board. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I'm writing a note down here. Give me 1 second. Colleagues, we're pretty much going to go down the schedule except for two exceptions. We have two guests from the other chamber here, and so we are going to do HB 2789 first, and then we're going to jump down to the bottom of the work sessions and do 2183 second. Senator Courtney is excused on business of the Senate, and we'll come back to that bill and add his vote if he wants to at a later time if we do move that bill. And then we'll go back to the top of the schedule. So, colleagues, what we're going to do is open a public hearing on HB 2789. Council, if you would be, Representative, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2789 requires schools to drill and instruct for safety threats, including lockdown procedures, twice per year. It declares an emergency is effective on passage. There is a Dash 1 amendment that simply conforms the FEMA reference to drop, cover, and hold on. It was in the statutory section being affected by the measure, and so we took the opportunity to make it conform to the federal language.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Boquist and committee members. My name is Betty Comp. I serve House District 22. That's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and Northeast Salem. I come to you as a former educator, a middle school principal, a high school assistant principal, and a parent and a teacher that always wanted to make sure that fire drills were practiced and so that everybody knew where they were supposed to go. House Bill 2789 goes a step further than our kind of not old-fashioned but needed, but desperately needed in the future, earthquake drills and our fire drills. I am proud to say that I was one of the people that served on our safety committee in our district for a number of years and actually wrote the protocols for the recent fire drills, and that when the high school caught on fire a year ago, just about almost exactly right now, that everybody got out of that building safely and they followed the drill, and that's what it's all about. Our recent history with violence of intruders, students that come in with weapons, and it's just hard to say, and that lives are lost because these circumstances have changed the need to have a different type of a drill. And some school districts do what is called a lockdown drill. My experience was that we did these working with our police department. Through the good chair's recommendation, the suggestion has come forward that there's cooperation here that needs to happen with our public safety officers in the community along with the schools. We always knew where the fire trucks were going to pull up, but we didn't talk very much about, I did some disaster training along with this. We didn't discuss that when firemen or the emergency care people come in, they will triage patients and what that triage looks like and how they do steps in the criteria of who gets transported first and how the affected people are taken care of. These are important steps. They're unless you think through them and make sure that many of our schools have been remodeled or are in changing buildings, that staff needs to be reminded so they can keep their students safe if such an emergency happens. That is the purpose of this bill. I think your student safety and your staff safety are the most important things that we as administrators do in a school, and to work with the local community fire chiefs, police chiefs, ambulance services to make sure we do have a coordinated plan. And this bill will do that for us. And I'm open to any questions. And our good chair, is very well versed on this subject. So thank you, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, question? Chair Olson?
Yes, thank you, Representative, for your testimony. Question, are you leaving the required requirement of this to the school as to where the children should be located and where they should move, or do we have a standardized procedure from the state?
To my knowledge, we do not have a standardized procedure. In fact, the individual school council site committees work with the administration frequently so that parents also know where their children are going to be located. Because in certain, let's say, in a fire, you might have students go to one exit area, but if the lockdown, if it's a gunman, then you don't exit, and so then it's a community school-based decision for each school.
When that process begins, will fire life safety, police, and all that be involved to discuss the best options for the children as to what happens and where they go?
Yes, that is the goal.
All right. Thank you.
And just for the record, colleagues, you'll recall we had discussions previously on the Department of Homeland Security guidance and the DDPST, which we had in our previous hearing, talking about the active shooter program, coordinated responses. Probably two-thirds of the state has been covered already in the regional training program. In some cases, they need a little bit more broader or more allowable language for local decision makers and teachers and superintendents and principals and law enforcement to coordinate those activities that they need to coordinate. And I'm quite familiar with that. I just came from Sheriff Roberts' briefing on the Clackamas Town Center, and there's three or four of our members still over there on that debriefing over there. And the coordination is critical. Representative, the only thing, I think I corresponded with your staff and talked to them, as you mentioned in your testimony, a couple technical conforming things we're going to do,
right,
and then we'll get the amendment. We'll make sure you get a copy of the amendment well in advance, because we'll do a work session next week on it.
Sounds great.
And then we'll go from there. Thank you very much. I am going to go ahead and keep this open because there's only three other individuals to testify. I have Tim Fountain, Kurt Hawley, and General Caldwell, if you'd like to come up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And thank you for bringing this forward.
You're welcome.
Okay, somebody might have signed up for the wrong bill. That's okay. Don't feel embarrassed. Are you it, General?
Yeah, I signed up for the wrong one. Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. No.
But you had guts enough to come up as a county commissioner, right?
That's correct. So we'll just wing it. No, actually, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Military Department. And we want to lend our support to this kind of, or this 2789 and this kind of legislation in general. However, as you and I, Mr. Chairman, have discussed in the current law, some things are not consistent depending on the type of buildings you're in, i.e., The standard in an earthquake is duck, cover, and hold. In some buildings, that would be a big mistake. And so we've got to probably work on that at some point. If we don't do it now, we have to do it later. But
General Caldwell, the amendment that was mentioned is the conforming language to get us into the bill we already passed.
That
we get everything on the same sheet of music, and we don't have a Scribner's end of session bill, I think.
Yeah. I appreciate that. I thought that's what was going on, but I wanted to bring it to your attention. We support the bill. We think it's good language, and it means a lot to have these kind of exercises so we can save lives when we need to. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close. Is anybody else that wants to testify on 2789? And for the record, this will be carried to next week for a work session. And if there is someone that wants to come forward and testify next week, the chair will allow that. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 2789. I understand the good representative is here for a work session on House Bill 2183. And so I'm going to open.
Just if you had questions.
You could go back, and I don't think anyone has questions. So I'd prefer to wait, hold the work session at the end, if that's okay. All right, thanks. Okay, colleagues, we are going to go back to the top of our calendar, as most of the people, there's a bunch of people are, so they're obviously expecting us to do that. Go back to the top of our calendar, and I'm going to open a public hearing on 2037A. Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2037A. Instructs health professional regulatory boards to license spouse or domestic partner of active service members. Requires qualifying spouse or domestic partner show competency in 1 year teaching or providing services in the past three. Allows health professional regulatory boards to issue temporary licenses under certain circumstances. Directs the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to establish rules expediting licensure for military spouses or domestic partners of active service members. Requires military spouses or domestic partners be licensed to teach in another state and subject to military transport to Oregon, declares emergency, is effective on passage. This measure moved out of two House committees, Veterans and Healthcare, respectively, both on unanimous votes as well as off the floor with a unanimous vote.
Thank you, Council. In general, unfortunately, DOD trumps you. Mr. Sansui.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, my name is Mark Sansucci. I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest. I'm here to express Department of Defense support and appreciation for HB 2037 to help our military spouses with military license portability. For 2013, this issue is still our number two issue for military family issues within the Department of Defense, and you folks passed number one last year with occupational license credit for our new veterans, so appreciate that. Just down to a few basic facts, the Defense Manpower Data Center has lots of data, and we know that 95% of military spouses are women, and we know that they move at a rate that's something like almost 14 times the rate of a civilian spouse, and that we know that in Oregon, as of last October, Oregon has 933 active duty military spouses and 5,343 reserve military spouses. We know that around 53% of them are employed, and of those employed, roughly one-third of them require licensing or some type of certification. So if we just considered the movement of active duty spouses, and General Caldwell can address the reserve component as he has in past hearings, that would be roughly about 120 military spouses who could be helped by this measure. We really appreciate the amending language on 2037 because a 2012 Defense Department, Treasury Department report showed that the number one occupation for military spouses is pre-K through 12 school teachers. So particularly the school teaching provision in there is wonderful. And also registered nurses are the third largest number. In between that are child care workers. So also as of right now, 34 states have done measures to provide for the expediting of a temporary or provisional license for our military spouses who move from one state to the other. And just this session, Arkansas, Georgia, Idaho, Maryland, Mississippi, New Mexico, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming have done it, and including Oregon, seven other states are taking it up as we speak. So I just want to express our appreciation and support for this and ask you to please move it forward. And thank you, and I stand by for any questions.
Thank you. General, if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. As you can see by the bill heading, we ask that this be introduced by the governor, pre-present session filed. We're working with Mr. Sanssouci on that to try to get this moving in cooperation with the Department of Defense. Just data, this doesn't really impact us as much as it does the active duty folks, because our folks are pretty much typically Oregon Guardsmen anyway. We got about 8,600 Oregon Guardsmen, and I would guess the statistic that Mark used, about 95% of them probably have spouses, or 95% of them. What does matter, though, is we have about 150 to 200 of our soldiers and airmen on extended active duty tours of all over the world, but the majority of them are in Washington, D.C. at the National Guard Bureau. And this would impact them. It would impact them directly because these are extended tours. They're usually 3 to 5 years long, and they may re-up and stay even longer, but that's a huge impact for us because we recall them home to put them back into other positions and take advantage of the expertise that they've learned back there working in that environment. So that would definitely impact them, and we think that's important that we try to do what we can to help that group of our soldiers and airmen. Concludes my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Advice, your questions?
Well, yes. So you're a nurse and you come to Oregon, and usually don't you, or at least I, when I lived in Virginia before I moved to Oregon after I got my nursing license, and you just apply to the board, and they would issue a nursing, you know, an Oregon nursing license. This doesn't, I think I need a little more clarification about why someone couldn't come in to this state as long as they, you know, became licensed through the board.
Through the chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, I'm not sure I'm the one who can speak to that. I know that when this bill was on the House side, representative from the nurses board was testified, and as a matter of fact, amended something to include the word "and" instead of "or," and I have not heard of any other opposition. One of the things that we emphasize is expediently providing that to get the spouse to work sooner rather than later. So agreed in many respects. If the license is comparable, then if they can expediently get a temporary or provisional license and get to work tomorrow, that's what we seek.
So do we have more to testify?
No.
So about, I know getting your teaching certification for the state of Oregon, is that usually more lengthy? I mean, again,
Madam Chairman, Senator Bonus Anderson, not being a teacher, I have two daughters that are teachers, but I know it's not. It's not like going to the DMV and waiting in line for 2 hours. I can tell you that. But I think with the, if you look on the second page, number 3, sub 3, it says a board may issue a temporary authorization to an applicant who applies for an authorization under Section 2 of the Act. I think this is encouraging the boards to be flexible. Is what is really, the legislature is telling them to be flexible, and you may issue that. I think hopefully time will show that they are doing that, and then we're going through the paper and catching back up after the fact, but I think we'll have to monitor that and see. So that's really kind of the issue, I think.
Okay, because I would just, I mean, it just makes sense that they would, that we should mandate them to issue a temporary, if they show, a temporary authorization, but I guess May is what we came up with, if they provide all the other information.
Well, and through the chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, Agree wholeheartedly, except for in many of the states and most of the states that have passed measures for the expedient processing for military spouse portability, specifically mentioning teachers. There's only been about eight states that have done that. So I think we think it's still helpful that teachers are specifically mentioned in this
I agree. Okay. Thank you.
Please.
Gentlemen, if a person comes in with a degree or a certificate from another state and we give them the temporary authorization and the comparison between our state and their state doesn't line up in their educational requirements, do we give that person that's come here an opportunity to meet our standards, or is it necessary that they meet our standards?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, our intent is never to tell a state that they have to accept someone who's less than qualified and does not meet the same standard as your state. So however the state agency that regulates that deems as appropriate is what we favor, and maybe Senator General Caldwell may concur.
Let's not make him a senator yet.
Yeah. And I don't want to take a step down. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think that's the appropriate approach. I think we're going to have instances where the standards don't line up. This does not address the fact that you just indicated. Is there some sort of can you maintain a temporary license until you get that certification? It could be another class or something. This doesn't deal with that. So I would assume that if the board chose to, and as they have the option to issue a temporary authorization, then that would be concluded at that point unless they make rules subsequent to that, which I think this does allow them to do that rulemaking. Is it a question of whether they choose to or not?
Follow, please.
Sirs, I think this is a great bill. It's going to help our military. It's going to make it easy for transition. Most people, when they leave a practice, whatever it may be, and come to another area, it's difficult to get reestablished. This will really simplify it and make those transitional trips for the military, because military soldiers move a lot, and it'll benefit them. I think this is a good bill. The only thing I would probably look at is the agency that would do the licensure, if they would in fact allow them to have that, carry on that temporary permit while they're getting educated to our standards, if there is a differential.
Yep. Madam Vice Chair.
Did the Oregon Medical Board testify at all?
I don't. I believe they were in the audience, but I don't.
Yeah.
Hearings through the chair, Senator Monis Anderson, and the other two hearings on the other side, they did not.
Okay. I know that this, the Oregon Medical Board is a professional regulatory board, and I do know that getting your Oregon medical license for a physician can be very lengthy, and then you have to be credentialed also at facilities if you're going to work in a hospital. This bill can still pass without that, but if I would really like to know if there are problems with certain spouses or domestic partners who can't get jobs. So hopefully you will be aware of them and then bring it to our attention if we need to further amend statute to put the hammer on them.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this? Council, if you'd be kind enough, we're going to schedule this for a work session next week, but I would like you to reach out to the House committees and find out which agencies did testify over there.
Mr. Chair, I just looked on OLIS, and the only two that testified were the General and Mr. Sensui.
That's correct.
Okay.
I could and make an invitation to reach out to the medical board.
If you would just reach out to the medical board, the nursing board, and Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Mm-hmm. This has been to three committees before us. I would assume if they had something to say, they could come, but that's a bad assumption in government. Mm-hmm. So if you'd reach out to those three agencies and ask them just to send us an email back to the committee members of their position on the bill. Not that it would change my vote, but I'm open to the opportunity. Any other discussion, colleagues?
With that, we're going to close the public hearing on HB 2158. We're going to open an informational meeting on the 2010 Veterans Transportation Task Force recommendations. I'm going to ask the ODOT group to come up first because I think there's three of you, and we only have three chairs. Oh. Right. I'm correct to close the public hearing on 2037.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hal Gard. I am the Rail and Public Transit Administrator for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you for having us here today. I'd like to introduce Tim Fountain with Rogue Valley Transit District and Curtis Hawley. He's with the Veterans Transportation Service. I'm going to start this off, and I know that the committee is short on time, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief because I'd like to give the majority of my time to my collaborators here. So in 2009, Senate Bill 98 set up a task force, which was chaired by my predecessor, Michael Ward, and the legislative task force was to really work on veterans transportation issues. A report was produced in October of 2010, which identified 15 individual recommendations that, if implemented, would improve access to veteran-sponsored medical services. Of those 15 recommendations, seven directly fell on ODOT to partner or lead the effort. Of those seven, we've made substantial progress on four, and three we have not. And I'm going to lead with my chin and talk about the three real quickly that we haven't made much progress on. Here are the recommendations. Seek federal funds for veteran transportation. Partner with the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs and the Federal Veterans Administration to eliminate barriers to adequate transportation for veterans. Work with Oregon Department of Veterans Services to better coordinate available public transit. Initiate a pilot project to leverage existing efforts. Create a veterans information booklet. Ensure that vets' needs are included in local transit planning efforts, and work with the Veterans Administration regarding their policy to only accept new accessible equipment. The three areas we have not made progress on is to seek federal funds for veterans transportation. We have not had any success in this area. The Federal Transit Administration, which is the main source of my funds for public transit, are not available for transit operations exclusively for vet services. If they do become available, we will, of course, pursue those funds quite vigorously. We also haven't tackled the effort of coming up with a veteran-specific information booklet. And that's simply because the time's not quite ripe yet for us, and some of that will be clear in a moment. My division is currently undergoing a reorganization where we are actually embedding regional transit coordinators out into the five transportation regions in the state. We wanted to get that effort up and going and successful so that information could be included in the booklet. The medical service providers are currently reforming around the new community care organization structure. We wanted that information to be available, to be included in the booklet. And finally, we wanted to incorporate the learnings from this pilot project that we'll present here at the end. So we will take that on, it's just we haven't at this time. And then finally, we have not worked directly with the Veterans Administration regarding their policy to accept only new equipment. It's our understanding that is being worked diligently at the federal level and with the FTA, directly with the VA. So we have not jumped in the middle of that at this time. So the areas where we've made progress. To partner with ODVA and the Veterans Administration to eliminate barriers, we identified that one of the primary barriers was a lack of accessible vehicles available to transport vets to medical services. In cooperation with our other partners, our federal and state partners, we gathered together representatives to work on a vehicle donation project. In April and May of 2012, we were able to donate eight accessible vehicles for use in VA facilities in Vancouver, Washington, White City, and Walla Walla. we learned some pretty important lessons from that. At the outset, the project looked very promising. However, it proved to be pretty problematic. The vehicles that we donated were already beyond their useful service life, and that was how we were able to donate them. We were able to basically surplus them out. And at this time, already half have been removed from service due to mechanical breakdowns. There's been a high maintenance cost for the remaining vehicles. So it was a good try, but the cost-benefit to the solution really didn't pan out. The positives were is we did start learning how to work and talk better with our partners in the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs and with VA. So we will continue to explore ways where we can improve. We've also continued to work with the Department of Veteran Services here. We collaborated on the vehicle project. We've collaborated on the pilot project that we'll get to in just a second. And we co-funded a Transportation Human Services Coordination Study along with the Association of Oregon Counties. That report is out in draft right now and will be finalized hopefully this June. And we look forward to implementing the recommendations in that report. And then finally, before we go to the pilot project, we were asked to include local transit planning efforts or make sure that local planning efforts included veterans' transportation needs. It was very low-hanging fruit. We currently mandate a planning process called the Public Transit Human Service Coordinated Transportation Plan. It includes 42 local transportation coordination plans across the state. They are all adding emphasis for veterans' transportation as those plans come up to be updated. And the providers must have updated plans to be eligible for any project funding. So that's completed. So with that, I'm going to turn quickly to the project pilot. I'm going to tee it up. As you probably know, in Oregon, transportation coordination is just a fact of life. There isn't any one transit agency that has enough resources to provide all the services statewide. I haven't been around long enough to know when the brokerages were started, but there are 7 transit agencies statewide who develop brokerages where they can coordinate services across the state. We identified $100,000 to start up a pilot project. To work on better coordination, making sure that those services are available to our veterans. We have 3 transit agencies that are participating. We have Rogue Valley Transportation District, the Central Oregon Intergovernment Council is participating, and the Cascade West Council of Governments is also participating. But I have my Southern Oregon friends here to talk about the pilot. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Tim and Curtis to share their findings.
Hello, my name is Curtis Holly. I work for the Roseburg Healthcare System, the VA there. I am the mobility manager there, and they hired me to do a lot of what he just talked about. And my job is to find rides for vets. And they call me my office, I find them a ride. And in doing so, I work closely with Tim and his pilot project.
Chairman Vilquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Fountain. I am the alternative transportation manager for the Rogue Valley Transportation District in Medford, Oregon. Operate a Medicaid brokerage in Southern Oregon that covers Jackson, Josephine, Douglas, Coos, Curry, Lake, and Klamath. We serve about 96,000 eligible Medicaid clients under that brokerage. Through the pilot, we felt that the money that we were given would benefit all communities, all counties that we serve, and decided to implement the pilot for all of those counties. It's been very successful. We've seen a lot of requests come through coordination where we get the request, coordinate with the VA to see if there's existing services before the brokerage steps in and transports veterans. A lot of these areas are very rural communities without transportation, access to accessible vehicles, and through the brokerage, we're able to utilize existing resources to manage those requests and successfully get people to and from their medical appointments. And I'm open for any questions.
Vice Chair? Mayor Olson?
I do have one. You had mentioned a large series of counties in there, including, I believe you said, Coos County. Yes. But I noticed on this flyer, it said that it was on the, you could be picked up on the I-5 corridor. How do we accommodate those folks?
Sir, this is just my program alone.
Oh, okay.
It's part of the processes that we put in Roseburg was just not working with TransLink, but working with RVTD, LTD, Coastal Express, Southwest Point, Amtrak, Greyhound, churches, assisted living facilities. I'll utilize every one of those resources to get a vet a ride. And Tim's service is, I would have to say, invaluable. When I first came here a year ago, the only veteran transportation really available was what the DAV provided from White City, and that's solely dependent on donated vehicles and volunteer drivers. And our volunteer driver pool is gradually getting smaller. We're not getting the volunteers that we once had, and that's a nationwide problem in the DAV. And Tim came on board, and we worked together, and his program alone has saved the VA thousands of dollars. Every missed appointment costs the VA $200. And working with him, a lot of the veteran population that would have missed appointments and gotten better care, they would not have without his program in place.
Thank you.
Thank you. And on behalf of Oregonians, we appreciate all three of your support to veterans.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Booker, Mr. Mann, if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Back in 2008, the governor, at the time, Governor Kulongowski, created a task force on veteran services, and during that time, we went to 24 communities in the state, and we had town halls. And in all but the ones where there was mass transit, transportation was one of the key issues. So when we wrote our report, the final report from that task force, we said we needed another task force. We needed to examine transportation because it was such a broad and wide issue statewide other than in the Portland metro area, honestly. So we did this next task force, and we thought we would be really smart and get ODOT to be involved. We thought we'd get DHS to be involved because we knew about this brokerage system that already existed for the Oregon Health Plan patients. We got the military department involved. We got Jimmy Booker over here involved from the employment department. And we invited a whole bunch of other people, including, which was important, the Disabled American Veterans Service Org. They have the only systematic veterans transportation in the state, 26 vans that in partnership with the federal VA pick up veterans in the morning, drive them to their appointments at the hospitals and clinics, and drive them back home. It's the only thing that exists. And so as we started to look at the problem, we identified several big things. One, nobody at the federal or state level has said it's a policy of either the feds or the state to provide transportation to veterans to anything. It's just not a policy. Two, there was no transportation for non-ambulatory veterans. So if you were in a wheelchair or you were non-ambulatory for other reasons, multiple sclerosis, for example, or Parkinson's disease. Also, if you needed oxygen, you could not ride the DAV vans because of the agreement they had with the federal VA about who they could take and who they could not take. So for the 700-plus wheelchair-bound veterans in the state, there was no way for them to get to their appointments if they couldn't get there themselves. We found that there were some veterans that are eligible for the Medicaid rides but didn't know it, so they were trying to get on the VA ride when they could actually use the Oregon Health Plan's Medicaid brokerage system, and so we were trying to work that out. And we came up with these recommendations, and I have to say that ODOT has been the most wonderful, fabulous partner that we've ever had in doing things. Michael Ward, and from their director on down, providing those vans, even though that they broke down later, was a huge, huge barrier to overcome. I was in a meeting with the FTA and the federal VA, and we're sitting at the meeting saying, why won't you let us give you stuff? And they looked across the table and said, we never said you couldn't give us stuff. And all the VA people in the room from Portland and Roseburg and White City kind of went red because they had been told forever that they couldn't accept stuff. And so we got through this barrier where we were able to give vans, and it was a great thing. And some of those vans are still working. And non-ambulatory veterans are being picked up. I know out of the Portland hospital that's happening. And so we're very excited about that. Some really good things, not just the fact that we started talking together and working together. At one point, the legislature, through the Ways and Means Committee, did give us $100,000. to our department, and we were going to use that to broker rides through this brokerage system for these non-ambulatory veterans. But what the legislature giveth, they taketh away, and there was a budget reduction, and we lost that money. But then ODOT calls and said, well, we're going to refund that $100,000, and we're going to take over this brokerage system idea that you have from the task force, because the idea was, why reinvent the wheel? We're already providing rides to literally tens of thousands, if not more, Oregonians to their medical appointments. How do we get the veterans in that existing system? Why recreate it? And so that's what this whole idea was that we talked about earlier about the brokerage system and getting veterans involved in that and those rides. So we feel really good about where we're heading with this. I would tell you that it's a complex problem because the way the state is set up. When you get over in the east side, LeGrand area, for example, and you've got to go to Walla Walla for your appointments, and winter comes, you don't go to your health care. If you don't have transportation, you don't go to your appointments. I have a gentleman right now in Salem who has a vocational rehabilitation appointment in Portland on Monday. He can't get there. I cannot get him to the Portland regional office from Salem. I just can't get him there. And so we had to postpone. And so there are real struggles. And so the question that I guess I would leave you with is, as we talk about veterans transportation, is that something that's a policy of the state? We did the task force. We turned in the reports. We talked about this. But the federal government, what they do is they say, if you come and drive to an appointment at the VA, we'll reimburse your mileage. And if you're non-ambulatory and you really need a ride for a service-connected appointment, we'll give you that ride. But that's as far as the feds go. From the state perspective, we don't really have anything other than what we've cobbled together between the agencies, between DHS and their brokerage system, and ODOT and the wonderful work they do, and ODVA and employment trying to push it. But there's really no coordinated statewide, the legislature has said to do X, Y, or Z. So that's kind of where we are in this. We're doing the best we can. I think that we're not being super successful, but we keep up coming up with these innovative ideas that we think that are getting some traction. So we're excited about that, and we would very much like some legislative direction as to how you'd like us to proceed in the future regarding veterans transportation.
Oh, you can stop right there. Just so it's clear, I'm going to be highly doubtful I get contradicted by the committee members, but you're to continue cobbling this together until we come up with a coherent policy.
Roger that, sir.
Go ahead, Mr. Brooker.
Good afternoon, Chairman Boquist, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Booker. I'm with the Oregon Employment Department and the Federal Programs Manager there. I was also a member of the task force when it was convened, and I'm an Air Force veteran. I wanted to give you I wanted to give you a little anecdotal piece to help continue the conversation on the need for transportation. In 2005, we had been asked by a previous Veterans Committee what were some of the gaps in veteran services, and one of the ones we came up with was a transportation issue, particularly for job-seeking veterans. We were given $54,000, and we used that to buy bus passes and gas vouchers for the veterans. And in my testimony, you can see that we served 748 veterans, 53% who used that service obtained jobs. And, you know, it was, I think, a successful and useful thing. The point of what I have to say is that the need continues. I surveyed our veterans representatives around the state and the local offices, and they say this continues to be an issue. So, you know, we spend quite a bit of time and money to prepare our veterans to go to war. I think we need to continue to spend time and money to help them return from war. And this is one of the things that will help them. Thank you very much.
Madam Vice Chair, questions?
So this is informational.
Check.
We don't have any legislation, so we can't make a request. So 2014 isn't really a budget year. I guess we could always go to the emergency board to request funding. But in these tough times, I mean, the amount of money that you would need is, I think, minuscule for the big budget. And I feel that somehow we need to craft a
mechanism to get the money from the co-chairs. Yes, I have that written down.
Yes. And maybe there's a budget note this time.
Mr.
What's a reasonable number? put you on the spot.
Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair, I would tell you that when we were talking that $100,000 figure, when we were just looking at the non-ambulatory veteran piece, we were pretty comfortable with that number, given the number of non-ambulatory veterans. We wanted to start small, honestly, to make sure it worked before we started a big program. We love the fact that ODOT kind of jumped in and picked it up. I've got 82 employees at our agency. They've got a few more than we do, so I think they have a little bit better infrastructure to help us make that program work. I worry about Jim Booker's program because from the employment perspective, when we can't have someone be able to have transportation to go to a job interview or go to the job that they've actually been awarded, it creates this gap that's for us, it's not a big deal, but for these veterans, it's a massive deal. And so we're not. You heard them talk about $50,000. You hear us talk about $100,000. It is budget dust, but in terms of how the process works, it's still general fund. And so I would be comfortable with that $100,000 to start just to make sure we can pull it off and do it, and we do it the right way, and it works, and there's measurables that we can come back to the legislature with to say, this is how it worked, and this is why it worked, and this was the cost per ride, because when you get into the details of the task force report, you'll see we talk about cost per ride, and that's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of when you say, how much does it cost? What we do is do the math backwards and say, cost per ride is X, and you can serve this many veterans by that cost per ride.
It would be nice, even this budget cycle, to have, we can request a budget note. I mean, and say, and I forget exactly what you need, but you do need to know what your outcome measurables will be, and then the amount. Let's just try it.
Okay, Mr. Mann, if you would get together with the employment and ODOT and give us a short summary and a one-pager of how we would apply and what the performance and metrics are for a $100,000 request downstairs, and get that to Cheyenne, and she'll distribute it to the committee. And I just happen to sit on an interesting work group that's discussing this topic.
So, roger that.
Senator Olson, anything further?
Sounds great to me.
Okay.
Let's make it $200,000.
I have to tell you, we're not fighting over 100 millions. We're fighting over shekels these days. So thank you very much. I appreciate the update. Committee appreciates the update. And once again, I will say thank you to ODOT for their hard work on this particular issue. With that, colleagues, we're going to move to a public hearing on HB 2158A. We're going to have a little bit, council's disappearing. This is a kind of a work in progress. I'm going to ask that Emma Calloway, is Emma here? Emma Calloway from the Oregon Student Association and Bridget Burns from universities. I don't know, there's Rep. Matthews. You want to bring somebody else up here too?
If you don't mind, I'll just hit it myself and then we'll see where it goes.
You can go from there. They're signed up, doesn't matter. What we're going to do is council's going to give us a little background. I'm going to have you give a little speech, and if you can spare us just a little bit of time.
Absolutely.
Because you know there's a little bit of work in progress here, and then I'm going to ask the other two senators to chime in on some other conceptual ideas, too, and we're going to kind of have a public hearing discussion here because we have to have a quorum and be in a public hearing to have this discussion. So, council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2158A requires public universities and community colleges to charge in-state tuition of undergraduate veterans discharged from service under conditions other than dishonorable if specified criteria are met with regard to elementary or secondary school attendance. Requires no more than in-state tuition plus half the difference between resident and non-resident rates be charged by public universities and community colleges of any veteran discharged under other than dishonorable conditions, graduate or undergraduate. Declares emergency is effective on passage. There is one formal amendment before you, the -A8, and a couple of discussions as to further amendment. The -A8 replaces the measure. It requires public universities and community colleges to charge in-state tuition for all honorably discharged veteran undergraduates regardless of residency. The discussions that I'm aware of that are underway refer to residency, permitting otherwise eligible veterans to show residency almost immediately. That is, the existing residency requirements would remain the same. but there would be a means for, within the first 12 months of enrollment, for a veteran to demonstrate and be considered a resident without having to wait the year. There is another discussion for waiver of tuition for Purple Heart recipients or their surviving spouse or their surviving dependent, modeled after the existing Veterans Dependent Tuition Waiver Program that's also being discussed.
So, Representative, if you would, please, and then we'll have a discussion of how we want to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, and great to see my senator here. So I'll just give you just a real brief kind of flyover on the background of 2158, which was initially the attempt of in-state tuition for veterans, which is not new to these committees. It became kind of I thought initially there was a path to get the in-state tuition. Tuition equity had passed. We ended up with a fiscal that became very problematic. The fiscal from OUS was based on, I think, the immediate loss of revenue that they would suffer as a result of veterans currently engaged in OUS. I would have OUS with me here today, but I'm not wearing my hazmat level A suit, so they're somewhat toxic right now to me, but as I joke. But I want to share with you...
We can arrange that, Representative.
Yeah, no, I'm kidding, actually. We've been trying to get to a point here, because what House Bill 2158 represents is really an effort to get something. We wanted to get in-state tuition for all veterans. That was our goal. But it became really obvious to me that with the fiscal that we could not overcome, it was just not going to go anywhere. And to be honest, it's my third term. You have been here longer, but I have realized that there are certain bills that you feel good about moving, but when you're moving them to die, that's not such a great feeling. I wanted to get a step in the right direction. So I felt like, can we get some modification? Can we amend this bill in a way that moves us forward? And I feel like that's what you have before you. It is a step beyond what tuition equity provided towards our veterans. It includes graduate program, but it's not the bill that we wanted. It's just the bill that we have. And it is a step forward, which, again, was the ultimate goal. I'm well aware there's two bills that were accomplishing the same goal. One started in your chambers, one in ours. I respect that greatly. It's just that, again, with the fiscal that was there, difficult to overcome. I would suggest that, obviously, well open to amendments. It's your bill now, and do what you want, and I'm willing to concur. My ultimate goal is obviously to increase our benefit to the veterans that they have earned while respecting the potential burdens that it places on certain stakeholders, in this case, OUS. I think there's some things that we can do. Again, conceptually, Zach Reeves has done phenomenal work in our office. Bridget Burns has been wonderful to work with. Mark Sansusi's weighed in. And let me just say, as you know, Mr. Chair, Ms. Ross and, of course, Ms. Edwards, our committee administrators, have worked a lot on this issue as well, and I thank them for that. I think that we could probably consider enrollment available upon a certain date and minimize any fiscal because there wouldn't be that immediate withdrawal of funds that would come out of the OUS. So I believe prospectively date forward, say fall term, we might be able to address that. That would be a step. I think also making sure that we always maintain the physical presence in the classroom so that this doesn't become an online outreach effort would also be a way to address what we're after, because in our committee, sir, to be honest, we have always talked about presence in the classroom and not making this about online. I think online does blow the fiscal well beyond and out the roof. So our goal is trying to find a way. I think this is a great opportunity to have the discussion. I think your chief sponsor of 820 obviously serves in your committee. We are all very supportive of increasing our veterans benefits, but we have to just kind of understand where it came from. And as the chair of the committee, I take full responsibility for amending this bill of House Bill 2158 to move something forward that was a step further for our veterans, realizing, of course, it didn't get us where we were trying to go, but it did start moving us in the right direction.
Okay. That's one third. Senator Olson, your third, please.
I commend you for what you've worked on 2158. As you know, I authored 820.
And I signed it, sir.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate that wholeheartedly. You and many other legislatures are also on that bill. The fiscal part has been difficult for us. Another state, Indiana, has just passed the same bill to allow veterans to have in-state tuition. It's an appropriate movement for veterans. And it's appropriate in the respect that veterans take the oath of office. They take the oath of the Constitution for all 50 states. it's beneficial to our state that we bring these quality gentlemen and ladies to our state to become students. I actually had a conversation with a group of small woodlot owners, if you will, and I talked about Senate Bill 820 and in-state tuition. And lo and behold, there's a professor there from Oregon State University, and he was involved in small woodlots. And he said, he concurred with me, he said that those students that have come from the military, that have served their country and have been in his class, are far superior to the students that are in his class on a normal basis from straight out of high school. And he said he agreed with me 100% that they should have all the support necessary because they will be good additions to our state. And I agree with him, and I assume you agree with him also. I think there's a way we can get this through. The good senator to my right here also has some things that she'd like to add to it, but I think that by the end of the day, by the end of the session, that we will allow veterans from anywhere in the United States that have served our country. And I did put a little higher bar on it. I put it on there honorably discharged. I kind of looked at that level that said that, you know, if you're booted out because you're smoking dope or something like that, you shouldn't get that benefit. But if you served your country honorably, you should be able to have that benefit in our state. I think by the end of the session, we will have that. It's a good bill. There's many of us on it. There's over half of our legislative body is on that bill. And I would be glad to incorporate, which I did. I did a gun stuff on your bill to try yes, to get this to go forward. And I think we should be able to do this. And I think there's a way to get it done. I think the OUS has a little some concerns, but I think that we can overcome these. I think it's a real simple problem to overcome. And I think this we should do this, and I appreciate the time, and I appreciate your efforts for bringing your bill forward.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I appreciate and applaud your efforts as well. And I think that it was very helpful to have your efforts, and yours really was a very, you know, straight to the point, here's what we're going to do and what we're going to have. And allowed, I think, on our end, for us to amend something that at least keeps the conversation going and to not have something sitting in Ways and Means with respect to that process that might not make it out the door. And I appreciate your commitment, and I'm open to finding a way, Mr. Chair, to get this so that we get something. I have talked about things we've tried for a while. I'd like to talk about the things we're doing. Thank you.
Absolutely. And Madam Vice Chair, you have another conceptual idea, too.
Last Saturday, I was at a baby shower, and the father of the father-to-be was in the Philippines, special forces in the Philippines. His wife was in North Carolina on the Army base back there, expecting twins, and she's due in July. And we started talking about needs, and he said, Lori, we were talking among the, the GIs there were talking, and they really feel that those with Purple Hearts have really suffered. Other states are now starting, and Texas is one of them, and I can't remember what the other one is. Having their dependents be eligible for waivers of tuition. And so I had mentioned to our good chair that we would like to pursue this in 2014, because I had no knowledge about how many Purple Hearts we had in the state of Oregon, how many people this would be, et cetera. And he says, oh, let's do it. Let's see if we can do it now. We've got a bill. And so I am also proposing that. And I have no idea if your committee, I haven't even talked to you since it just happened last Saturday and the idea hadn't occurred to me. So I am, have you had familiarity with waivers of tuition for dependents? I know we do that with deceased, but...
Mr. Chair, and...
And by the way, the shower was Skyped. So Ken Hubert in Special Forces in Philippines, for
for the 2 hours that we had the shower was there, and his wife, who was in North Carolina, we Skyped, and we all had a very nice shower, by the way. Okay, go ahead.
For the record, I've never attended the shower with Skype, but
8,000 miles apart, too.
Yeah.
But Chair Boquist and Vice Chair Monis Anderson, as a committee, we've not talked about specifically about that, but we've had plenty of conversation regarding waivers, plenty of conversation regarding veterans' benefits related to education, and, of course, the relating clause in this particular bill allows us to do that. Our committees, I think, are very pro-veteran benefits, and sometimes we have to educate our members, but they're also bipartisan in nature, so, and nonpartisan in nature. So the bottom line is, I think if that amendment were to be drafted and into our bill, I think it probably, my guess, applies to a very, very small window of folks, but would have a very huge impact in their world. And I would be in favor of concurring that and talking to members individually to get that done. But I guess my goal, Mr. Chair, and for the committee, if we can, if 2158 becomes the vehicle, certainly that's the bill of movement, and it becomes a concurrence on our side. If 820 becomes the vehicle, then we just got to make sure we're related all the time constraints. But you know far more about that than I do. I only know about it because Ms. Edwards is back there to remind me of those things. So thank you.
And we appreciate that input, especially from our colleagues across the aisle. I do want to have the university system come up. You'd like to put your toxic suit on and move to one side. Because we are a little bit, we're farther down in the session here, so we need to have a little bit more open discussion than we would normally do to figure out a way forward. Because we have three different members, so there's a quorum issue, so the only place to have that discussion is kind of right here. So I'm going to let the university have some time here. I know there's been some side meetings with council. I've met with other representatives of the university. I think everybody's trying to figure out a way forward, what the bumper boards might be, how do we prevent it from disappearing into the dungeon and never coming out.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. Today I want to speak to you about a variety of options that you could consider to be able to amend this legislation, to be able to meet what your needs are, and at the same time give you an idea of the financial trade-offs so that you could design a package that would have whatever impact you're looking for, and you would be aware of whatever costs, how we would calculate them. Mm-hmm. To my right is Jan Lewis, who's the Director of Budget and Operations for the system, and she can walk you through how she would calculate the fiscal impact statement based on whatever options you're looking for, and she can explain further the fiscal that you've seen before you. I just want to give you a flyover of some of the policy ideas that you could be contemplating as you look at this Purple Heart idea, and also as you look at the idea of incorporating the provisions of 820 back into this legislation, how you might figure out what options work. So the first thing I would say is that OUS currently has a variety of programs benefiting veterans that we pay for, and I just want to flag those so that as a backdrop of knowing what currently exists. The first that I would flag is the Veterans Dependent Tuition Waiver, and this, when you're talking about those who have received a Purple Heart, it's very likely that we might be catching many of those folks in that group. However, it would be very easy for us to design and develop a program specifically for people who have or are dependents of those who have Purple Hearts. And I would recommend looking at the former foster child waiver that we developed in 2011. I think that's a good template to use. It's very simple. The question for us is we don't really know how many are out there, and we don't know what, I mean, so there's that's going to be a question in how we operationalize it. But I think we could design something for you. The one thing I would flag is that the fiscal that you have on this legislation, and you also saw with 820, said indeterminate, and there's a reason for that. With the Veterans Dependent Tuition Waiver, when we first implemented it, the first year there were 10 eligible students who used it, and that amount we waived was $43,000. But the next year, 228 students used it, and that was $965,000 for our institutions to incur. So when we say that it's indeterminate, it really is, it's going to depend on a lot of other factors. How many folks are going to be eligible? What kind of outreach is going to be built around it? Do we have veteran service officers on campus? So I would just flag that as backdrop. Additionally, we run the Voyager program, the Yellow Ribbon program, and the non-resident veteran fee remission. And we can explain more about those, but I think the most important one is the veteran-dependent tuition waiver. And I have sent on to Cheyenne information about this. And you'll have this in electronic electronic format. This explains that it basically waives tuition for any student who's a child, spouse, or anyone who's a spouse or an unmarried, unremarried surviving spouse of a member of the U.S. Armed Forces who died while on active duty, died as a result of a military service-connected disability, or is 100% disabled as a result of a military service-connected disability. The provision that that you need to think about is that that waiver is an eligible child must be 23 years of age or younger at the time when they apply. So thinking about things like that will definitely minimize some of the fiscal impact. The backdrop for us is the financial trade-offs. Because our institutions have a lot more students to serve, and ultimately the more waivers that we create, that somewhat thins the soup. We, however, prioritize these populations, and we're willing to work in any way possible. Just for your information, we're receiving an appropriation about the amount we received in 1990, but in 1990 we served 60,000 students, and we now serve 100,000 students. So adjusted for inflation, we're looking at about the same amount of money, and we're having to stretch it even thinner. So that's why we are trying to hope for as limited fiscal impact as possible to be able to provide resources for all of our students. We believe 2158 is a great step. It will be it's easy for us to implement, but let's talk about your options. First, on the idea of A8, the non-resident waiver that you talked about, which would be reincorporating 820, the questions that you should think about are first about timeline. Now, I've looked at the federal legislation that's currently pending, and it's likely to get out of the House committee. That legislation is the GI Tuition Fairness Act, I believe. That bill has just been amended, and what that includes is a one-year delayed implementation. So that is a bit. So 820, as it sits right now, is more robust than the federal legislation that would be coming. And that's important because what you'll see in the fiscal is the $1.4 million that we will talk about, that's primarily just serving students right now. So the longer time that you give us to be able to ramp up, you're going to be able to eliminate that fiscal impact that we would be able to articulate. So I would say that the options you should contemplate and could look at in terms of a portfolio: delayed implementation, like the federal provision, make it for new applicants only would be something you could think about. And that would eliminate the $1.4 million fiscal, because you'd be looking at, we wouldn't have to worry about the population we're currently serving. Finally, you could do all and make it start now, and then you're looking at a $1.4 million fiscal today, and that's because we're serving 193 veterans right now for undergraduate, and that would eliminate about $7,000 that they would be paying each. That, coupled with the 37, I believe, graduate students that we're also serving who are non-resident, and increasing decreasing their costs as well. So the other option you can think about is having an Oregon connection, and that's something you see in 2158A, where you would need to have a strong Oregon connection. Currently, you need to have lived here for 1 year and have moved here for educational-related, or not moved here for education-related purposes, but you could contemplate anyone, anywhere, and you could make it very similar to what 820 does, which is immediate. That's going to increase the expense, but that timeline piece is an important part. The last piece I would add, so that's about A8. In terms of the Purple Heart provision, this, I think we could take the veteran-dependent tuition waiver, and we could take the foster youth tuition waiver that we have, and build a possible portfolio of options to be able to identify what policy selection you'd like to make. The things to contemplate are you going to cover just tuition, or do you want to cover tuition and fees? Tuition and fees is obviously going to be a bit more, and just for your information, the foster youth program covers tuition and fees, and the veterans-dependent tuition waiver only covers tuition. The option that I would like to talk to you about next is a bit more complicated. It's kind of inside baseball, but it's how we calculate financial aid, and it's called last dollar, first dollar. And what that means is, when I meet a new student and I'm calculating their information, if I'm doing last dollar, I first grab their Pell Grant, and I look at their Opportunity Grant, and then any other aid they get, and then if there's any gap remaining for them in terms of need to meet the cost of tuition, that's a last dollar waiver. We would cover that cost. That's what we do for foster youth. We apply all their aid, because they usually get a Chafee grant and a Pell grant, and then in the end it makes it very financially affordable for us to provide those kinds of waivers. If it's first dollar, then we would waive starting immediately, and then later on, after you've reached tuition, the amount of tuition, then you apply their Pell grant. So it's it's, again, very kind of inside baseball. What I would tell you is the Veterans Dependent Tuition Waiver is middle dollar. And what that means is you apply the Pell Grant, you apply the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but the first institutional dollar is something that we waive from then on. So you're getting probably a little bit more of a benefit for students than you would if, than for instance, in the foster youth program where we're waiving last dollar. So again, I admittedly a bit technical, but if you want to make the program as affordable as possible, those are your options. The other option to consider is, are you going to cover dependents only, dependents and spouses, or dependents who are not remarried? That's entirely your choice. That's obviously going to impact the fiscal, but probably only a little bit. And then finally, the piece about resident versus non-resident. Covering this Purple Heart provision for residents, we think we could easily cover that. That shouldn't be a problem at all. The question about non-residents is we just don't know how many there are out there, and we don't know. Essentially, that sends a message that you would get a full ride potentially if you come to Oregon. So these are questions that you could contemplate and design any amendment you would like. We're here to provide any information you need. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I would otherwise hand it over to Jan to speak briefly on the fiscal if you have any.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Jan Lewis with the Oregon University System with Budget Operations, and as Bridget mentioned, our department is the one that coordinates with LFO on presenting fiscal information when it's requested. In terms of 2158, back at the initial bill when it was going to be applicable immediately, the part of the calculation that we felt we were able to quantify were those students who are currently in our population. And we have 193 undergraduates who are non-resident veterans. And in the graduate population, we initially thought there were 37. I recently found out it's up to 62. And we just, you know, if you want to do a broad brush impact on this, it's just what we are currently assessing the undergraduate non-residents is the resident rate plus half of the difference between resident and non-resident. For graduates, we're assessing them at the non-resident rate. And what 2158 did was on the undergraduate population, it lowered that rate to the resident rate. And then for the graduates, it gave them that discount that we currently have, which is the resident plus half of the midpoint. And so we just looked at the difference in revenue per student and took it against our population and came up with that 1.4 million. Now, as amended, it is for current, for new admits coming in, and so that changes it significantly. If you look at the campuses right now, they're in the middle of building their budget for FY14. They're looking at their current population of students, the res non-res mix, projecting their income. If that were to immediately change on July 1, they would have to deal with that. And now when we did this initially, we also were looking at this from an average tuition and fee perspective. And one of the things that I noticed in reviewing this information is our population of non-resident veterans are not spread equally across the campuses. If you look at the undergraduate population, it's Portland State, Oregon State, and Southern who hold the bulk of that population. When you go to graduate, U of O joins that group. So I think if we were to recalculate any of this, we would probably want to look at it on a by-campus aspect, because depending on the campus, it could be a more significant impact than to others. So that timing impact that Bridget mentioned is very important. In talking about the Purple Heart, yesterday when I became aware that this was a consideration, we did sort of a quick initial scan to see what was out there, and you may have more information than I on this. The only one we could find that offered it to children of Purple Heart recipients was South Carolina, and they did have a residency connection on theirs. We found Indiana, Florida, Alabama, and Utah were offering to residents, and some of the criteria that they had set up, it was a mix of tuition and fees versus tuition only. 110% of required credit hours. One of them limited it to 124 semester hours. I think, and Bridget alluded to this, that the challenging part on the Purple Heart aspect is determining what's the eligible population and then how many of those might avail themselves. I had a very interesting conversation with a gentleman connected with the Military Order of Purple Heart, and he gave me a lot of interesting anecdotes as to why even the national data is limited in that aspect. So that would be the hard part, and that sort of lends itself to why sometimes we do land on indeterminate, because rather than pull an estimate out of the air, sometimes we feel like that is more accurate. I did want to emphasize a little bit that some of these clarifications are not only helpful for the cost containment, but also when people have to implement these. You know, as soon as you hand over a broad brush bill, you start getting inundated with a lot of questions. Well, did they mean this? Did they mean that? What do we do in this situation? So I think some of the options that Bridget mentioned are very important, whether it's limiting on accredited hours. You know, at what point does this benefit drop off? In the case of the veterans dependent, a student has to be 23 year or younger when they first apply. So there's different aspects. And one in particular that I think is important is on the distance education. And the reason that's so important is that there was recent federal legislation in 2010, and it required that if you, if for example, Oregon offers their distance ed programs to students in other states, states are entitled to set up guidelines. And so right now there is probably 50 different versions out there as to what they would charge us to be able to offer that in their state, and they tend to have an initial one-time licensing fee, but then oftentimes it's a per-degree charge. So an unintended consequence could be that we might have one student sign up for distance education, and we would have an actual cash outlay to that state. So that, again, those little nuances are sometimes very important. So I would just also offer that if you have a sense of possible packages or scenarios you'd like us to consider, we would be more than happy to try and do a quick costing analysis to get back to you so you could kind of get a sense of the magnitude of the different options.
Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have time is of essence. So this is what I would like. Mm-hmm. Okay, Oregon Public Universities. Okay, limiting it to that at this point in time. The Purple Heart from the Afghan and Iraqi war, not going before that. Age 23 or under, obviously. Must be an Oregon resident. What else did you say I needed to have?
Vice Chair Montes-Anderson, Chair Boquist. I looked at last dollar, middle dollar, first dollar, probably deciding on that one.
Probably last dollar, but...
Vice Chair,
middle dollar.
Middle dollar is what we do right now for.
If you do a middle dollar, I forgot that you said that. So yeah, middle that dollar then.
And the only others would be questions about is it dependent spouses who are not remarried, and that's then the question about tuition and fees.
Up till Monday.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering.
This is my intent. My intent, just so you know, my Vice Chair, is to get a rig at the input and then ask the indulgence of the good chair of the House to cough up one of his staff members and with counsel here, and then I will sit down with one other member of either chamber so we don't get a quorum issue, and we will sit down in a meeting with the university system on Monday or Tuesday with a big Mentalite board, and we'll walk through until we can find something that will pass muster in the basement. You amenable to that, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. And we'll commit whatever time we have to make that happen. So thank you.
Okay, so go ahead, Madam Vice Chair.
Okay. That's for the Purple Heart.
And do you include recipients of the Purple Heart as well, or is it just children?
I was just thinking of dependents.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just thinking dependents.
Okay.
Senator Olson, your input, please.
Where do we begin? The section that brings me the most problem is Representative Matthews in your bill, when you had to insert the fact that they had to go to Oregon school or graduate from an Oregon school or somehow be connected to an Oregon school. That means they're Oregonians to start with. They'd get in-state tuition anyhow. They might have transferred with the military and gone somewhere else, but they most likely, in most instances, would have family here, and they would probably use the family residence as their residence to get in-state tuition. Pretty simple.
that's the part that hangs me up the most. If we said that this would begin, this has got an emergency clause. 820 has an emergency clause. If we eliminated the emergency clause and moved it to fall of this year and started from fall forward, not prospective or prospective, whatever the term is, but fall forward, does that help you financially? And does that help your fiscal?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, members of the committee, when we did that 1.4 calculation, that was not taking into account that Oregon connection aspect that you're mentioning. The key that really alleviated that piece was that it was going to be applicable to new admits, because it's really the current cohort right now that are paying, you know, the different rate that would immediately be paying a further discount rate that would impact next fiscal year. So I think the least impact would continue to use the new admits.
Follow up. Do you perhaps know the numbers from PSU, OSU, and Southern? Because I do.
No. Not off the top of my head, but
Portland State has the most by far.
Oh, yes.
Like 172.
Okay, that wasn't the number we got.
That's what we got directly from Portland State.
So did we.
and interestingly enough, the University of Oregon doesn't even track veterans. They don't even track veterans. The only way they know if the veteran, at least from the information we received from the University of Oregon, the only way they can track veterans is by the financial aid that's coming in. Is that correct?
Senator Olson, Chair Boquist, what we have in front of you over here to my right, and we'd love to share with you, and we'll clean it up and get it to you, compilation of every institution, the number of current students that they're serving who are veterans, and the number of graduate students that they're currently serving who are veterans, and the residency distinction. So she just threw this chart together after reaching out to all the folks in enrollment. We did get that information, so I'm not sure who you spoke to at the University of Oregon, but I'm happy to either connect with that person or direct them to the folks that we've spoken with.
We did some pretty intensive research on this, spent a lot of time on it to find out who was here, where they were, and how they were. And there was actually one institution that didn't even bother to call us back, which is okay. That's fine. The point being is that To connect it to tuition equity, that they had to have some connection to Oregon, really defeats the purpose. And the reason I say that is, if we're in Washington, where we have Spokane, the air base, and Lewis McChord, and stuff like that, there's a lot of GIs up there. But this is a bill, it's perfect for Oregon. It brings veterans to our state from out of state, and it brings their dollars with them. That's the important thing. And I understand that, you know, we talked about this, $16,000 for a veteran from out of state. But to bring these folks in here who are quality individuals, that brings new dollars, new federal dollars into our systems. That's going to benefit us. And when you look at your impact statement, ma'am, Ms. Lewis, on this one here, it says the Oregon University system estimates that the bill would be fiscal and revenue neutral at worst, but more likely to be revenue positive. And so these are the people I have to listen to. And you say you work with them. And if this is the case and you're coming up with a $1.4 million fiscal, let me ask you, what was the fiscal on the tuition equity bill?
Okay. Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, members of the committee. So probably on some of the wording of that, instead of likely, I would say it would be more accurate to say possible based on our polling of, you know, what other states had experienced. But the difference with the 820 and the currently amended 2158 is that timing piece, which is it only applies going forward. You know, we're looking at this in terms of campuses and adjusting, and they're going with, again, this immediate cohort and an immediate reduction. If they know and can plan that, okay, everyone we admit from this day forward that's a non-resident veteran, this is the rate they're going to be assessed, that's much more manageable than switching midstream.
Can you wrap it up here?
Yeah.
Okay, because I have a solution. So,
all right. How many students right now of the number that you gave us, how many students are in their second, third, and fourth year? And how many will graduate? You're going to lose those folks right away.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, members of the committee, We only have that breakout on one of the universities. As Bridget mentioned, we were sort of scrambling to get some more backdrop on this. So we are going to try and get it for the other universities. But we did, you know, in looking at this, we were starting to take into account those that would be graduating. So, yeah, it is a pipeline where they're moving through.
And the only thing I would say to that is that amazes me that you wouldn't have all those all that information. Every university should know their veterans from the get-go. And they should be able to tell you who's a junior, who's a sophomore, who's a freshman from the get-go. But that's me.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is what we're going to do, as the chairs and I have already agreed. Senator Olson's going to serve on the work group with me on our side, so we don't have a quorum. If you want to get a couple of people from your side, Mr. Chair, we'll get staff together. I'll ask the two university system to work with Cheyenne to set up a meeting time. We'll get a large room with a Mentalite board and bring a bean counter that knows how to do the numbers, and we'll walk through each of these scenarios and come up with something that is livable for everybody that we can pass without having to go into the face of the co-chairs downstairs. Amenable, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, yeah, exactly what I was thinking, sitting here, a lot of dialogue, but I will say, unfortunately, when people are killed in line of duty, and we're tracking, obviously, that benefit, they may have also been awarded the Purple Heart, so there may be some of those folks already qualified under that benefit, so I think that's a great proposal. As far as moving forward from a prospective date, I would just want to make sure that we're cautious that we don't exclude them from registering early for the availability of classes. And I guess my other point to that is, as much as I'd like to say every veteran currently attending the school and everything else, we'll have to find a starting point that works and passes, and it could be unfortunate that might be to new enrollees date forward instead of everybody currently in the system. But thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this has been wonderful and appreciate the response from the committee and the comments by all. And from OUS, too, I do want to say we have been working with OUS, and Bridget Burns and Zach Reeves in my office have been communicating daily, and we're trying to get there. And I really appreciate your commitment to this. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else? There was one other individual signed up originally for 2158. Is there someone else that wanted to make a comment? Come on, young lady. You must be Emma Calloway. Thank you.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, I'll keep my comments brief, but my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and I'm here today to speak in favor of 2158, and just wanted to put that on the record. We believe that those serving in our military do deserve in-state tuition and this increased benefit, especially access to public post-secondary education. We liked the engrossed A amendments, linking our veterans and hopefully enticing qualified veterans to stay in the state of Oregon. We can't think of any better program than public education to help keep these qualified professionals in our state, so we really like those pieces. Specifically, as the bill moves forward, we hope that you keep the provision about graduate students. We have a lot of students who go on to become officers after an ROTC program and then want to return to public education, and we think the graduate provision is a really wonderful piece of this bill. So we hope, Chair Boquist, as you're putting together that special committee, that you do consider keeping the graduate provisions, because we think that that's a great honor for officers that have gone on to serve in our military. So we support this bill, the veterans associations on our campuses, and really just wanted to speak from personally, as a child of a military family, we think that this bill is a really positive piece of legislation, and thank you very much for working with OUS and trying to come up with what is hopefully an affordable option, but also one that really does benefit our veterans communities in Oregon and keeps our veterans here after public education. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2158. Colleagues, in 10 minutes, we're going to move 10 bills. So,
okay.
with that, I'm going to open a work session on HB 2034.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2034 has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, so no statement issued. It was previously heard on the 25th of April. It permits the tribal governments to submit applications for federal funding related to emergency programs and services through the Office of Emergency Management for review and processing. It acknowledges that they may establish emergency management agencies, and it requires those who choose to establish emergency management agencies to appoint an emergency program director, establish policies as specified in the measure, jointly with county, with the county within which the tribal government operates, and it requires the tribal emergency management agency to perform certain specified functions within their territorial limits. And I'll repeat from the previous hearing, unanimous off the House floor and from the House committee.
And fiscal?
Fiscal statement issued.
Chair Boquist, I move House Bill 2034 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Montes-Anderson moves House Bill 2034 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Call roll, please.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Montes-Anderson?
Aye.
Chair
Boquist. Aye. Motion passes. I volunteer for the carrier. Senator Olson will carry 2034. With that, I'll close the work session on 2034. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2044. Madam Council.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2044, a fiscal statement issue, has no revenue impact. It authorizes the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to establish VIA rule, reasonable compensation for ordinary and unusual services rendered by ODVA as conservator and personal representative. It removes the ceiling on their compensation of 5% of income to the veteran's estate, declares an emergency, is effective on passage, again, unanimous off of the House floor and from the House committee.
Mr. Chair, I was noticing in the fiscal that it says a $260,000.
Other funds positive.
Oh, it's other funds. Okay. So, Chair Boquist, I move House Bill 2044 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Montes-Anderson moves House Bill 2044 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Courtney? Senator Olson? Madam Vice Chair? Seeing no discussion, call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Montes-Anderson.
Aye.
Chair Boquist.
Aye. Motion passes. I'll carry 2044. With that, I'll close the work session on 2044, open a work session on 2046.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, 2046 is the companion to 2044, also concerns the conservatorship program at ODVA. It permits ODVA to recuperate the cost of the program from an estate of a deceased client, permits them to retract a waiver of claims for costs if they find the payment no longer results in hardship and doesn't deplete the estate. It tolls claims against the estate from the date the claim was waived to the date the waiver was retracted. There's no revenue and minimal fiscal.
Chair Boquist? I move House Bill 2046 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Montes-Anderson moves House Bill 2046 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Senator Courtney? Senator Olson? Madam Vice Chair, call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Montes-Anderson?
Aye.
Chair
Boquist. Aye. Motion passes. I'll carry the bill. With that, I will close the work session on 2046 and open a work session on 2183.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2183 was previously heard on March 7th and March 21st. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on either the introduced version or the dash 2. This is the measure that Representative Boone was sitting to listen in on, removing the requirement that annual earthquake drills be held in April for employers of 250 or more full-time employees. The dash 2 is a refinement of language we discussed previously on a bill that had to do with school drills. FEMA's current language of drop, cover, and hold on is used in this measure, and the other drills, that is, other than drop, cover, and hold on, are permitted.
Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated May 1st, 2013.
Madam Vice Chair Montes-Anderson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 1 May 2013. Is there discussion, Senator Courtney?
No.
Senator Montes-Anderson?
Mm-hmm.
Senator, is there opposition?
No.
See no opposition, so adopted.
Chair Boquist, I move HB 2183 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Montes-Anderson moves House Bill 2183 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Courtney? Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Senator Olson, call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Montes-Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. I'll carry HB 2183 on the floor. With that, I'll close the work session in 2183. You need to go. Go ahead. With that, I'm going to open a work session on 2708A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2708A was previously heard on March excuse me, May 2nd. There's no revenue impact on the measures introduced or in the dash A2, and a minimal fiscal, so no statement issued, on the introduced version and the dash A2. This creates a fallen hero roadside memorial signs to recognize members of the United States Armed Forces killed in action or from wounds received in action, beginning with Eric McKinley and Tyler Troyer, both young men who live in the area of Route 34 to which this bill pertains. It directs ODOT to set and collect a fee for associated costs and establishes corresponding protocols. The dash A2 amendment, as we heard briefly last time from Representative Springer, adds the name of Kevin Davis, also a young man in the area of Route 34.
Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the dash A2 amendments dated April 12, 2013.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves to adopt the A2 amendments dated April 12, 2013. Is there discussion? Seeing none, so adopted. Let the rules, or let the reflect that Senator Courtney is excused on business of the Senate. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move House Bill 2708A as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves House Bill 2708 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Olson. Madam Vice Chair, call the roll, please.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Chair votes aye. Let the record show that Senator Courtney is excused in the business of the Senate. I will carry, actually, Madam Vice Chair, would you carry this on the floor?
I would love to.
Madam Vice Chair, we'll carry this one on the floor.
Oh, wait, that Senator Close was the one who...
Is it?
Yeah, I think
she
Senator
is listed as a
Senator Close.
So Senator Close, the first option of that, and Madam Vice Chair only if Senator Close is unavailable. Okay, with that, we're going to close the work session in 27.8A. We're going to open a work session on HCR 23.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 23 was heard on May 2nd. No revenue, no fiscal. This is the measure that honors U.S. military service members exposed to unsafe levels of radiation from nuclear weapons testing, referred to as atomic veterans, between 1945 and 1962.
Chair Boquist, I move HCR 23 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Monis Vice Madam Vice Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves HCR 23 to the floor with a be adopted. Is there discussion, Senator Olson?
No.
Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney excused. Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Motion passes.
There are a number of people on this, Senators, on it. Beyer, Edwards, Gerard, Johnson, Canope, Monroe, and Starr.
Do those additional sponsors, Mr. Chair? No other primary sponsors.
We have no primary sponsors.
But additional sponsors, there are a number of senators. I did inquire, but didn't receive a response.
Okay. Senator Olson? You're atomic.
You're atomic.
Okay. Senator Olson will carry this unless one of these other sponsors volunteers. That will close the work session on HCR 23, open a work session on HCR 24.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 24, previously heard also on the second, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. This supports the Veterans Treatment Courts, concentrating nonviolent criminal cases involving veteran defendants on the same docket before the same judicial official for case management by multidisciplinary teams and volunteer veterans.
Chair Boquist, I move HCR 24 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves HCR 24 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Discussion, Senator Olson. Madam Vice Chair, call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney excused. Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes. Do we need a carrier? Or do we?
Sure. I'll carry it.
Vice Chair will.
Or who is it? Go, Canope.
See if Senator Canope wants to do it. If not, then Vice Chair will do this one. We'll close the work session on HCR 24. Open the last work session of the day on HJM 9.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJM 9, previously heard on May 2nd. No revenue, no fiscal. This is the memorial that for the fifth time urges Congress to change the funding on veterans' health care from discretionary to permanent and direct entitlement. I am drafting a letter, Mr. Chair, for both of the committees to sign that would accompany the memorial should it pass.
Okay.
Chair Boquist, I move HJM 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves HJM 9 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there discussion? Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Monis Anderson?
No. Nope.
Call the roll, please.
Senator Courtney excused. Senator Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Aye. Motion passes. I've now seen Senator Canope on four bills in a row here, so please ask Senator Canope if he would like to carry this one.
If not, I'd like to carry that one. Healthcare.
Healthcare. You want it instead?
No, it's Ken Oakes.
Okay. Your discretion.
Okay. See if Senator Ken Oakes wants to carry one of these things and put his name on.
I think you'd say one of mine, Veterans Affairs.
Yeah, right. With that, I'm going to close the work session on HGM 9, and we are done for the day, colleagues.